Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claudia Monterrosa Rivera, the host of today's episode. And today we'll be talking to Dr. Sarah Walsh about her new book, The Religion of Life, Eugenics, Race, and Catholicism in Chile, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press in 2021. And which examines the interconnections and relationship between Catholicism and eugenics in early 20th century Chile. Dr. Walsh is the Hansen Lecturer in Global History at the University of Melbourne, and she specializes in the history of human sciences in Latin America with an emphasis on race and ethnicity. She received her PhD from the University of Maryland, College Park, and Sarah, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Claudia. And I do need to maybe apologize to your listeners that though I am affiliated with the University of Melbourne, I am American. So you won't get to enjoy a whimsical Australian accent today, unfortunately.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I wonder if we could begin this interview with you telling us a little bit about yourself and just getting us started that way.
Sure. So I, as I said, am not Australian, but American. And I grew up in New England, specifically in Amherst, Massachusetts. And many people do ask me if that means that my parents were professors, and they were not. They both did attend the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and then remained there. In many ways, I think my time in New England, I stayed there until my early to mid 20s, has shaped me in kind of unusual ways, as many of us are shaped by where we grew up. But particularly as relates to this book, my family, particularly my grandparents and beyond, were Catholic. And Catholicism plays a really important kind of social and cultural role in New England. And so that, I think, kind of has brought some questions to me intellectually that I didn't know that I wanted to answer, I suppose, until I got to graduate school. And you mentioned that I went to the University of Maryland, and I know that we're going to talk about that a bit later. Ultimately, I have enjoyed history and wanted to look back at the past to help us understand the present, more or less since the time I can remember. And I think, again, this kind of speaks to where I grew up. New England is just full of different kind of plaques and memorials and burial sites and places where, and historical homes and historical museums, all dedicated to varying moments in time. And so I guess in a sense, history was always all around me, and I always found it really intriguing. But in fact, I kind of grew tired of American history pretty quickly because of that, because it was built into so much of my kind of growing up experience. So as I grew into my more kind of intellectual pursuits, Latin American history became the way that I wanted to consider kind of big issues like racism or the power of science or the power of religious belief and faith. And I should also say, I think this is important, I don't have any Latin American family connections or Latino heritage. I am not speaking from that particular position, which I guess as well was part of what I think was important and is always important in the context of doing Latin American history is that I recognize that as a white woman coming from the United States, that my position relative to my material is different, but I do try and avoid looking at it from kind of a imperial perspective. I take it very seriously to try and put my research kind of into and put myself into, you know, the Chilean context that I interact with, both in terms of my own research trips in the present, but also in the context of the historical work that I do. So when we get to it, if you want, I can talk more about it. But I really worked very hard to not make the United States a meaningful kind of component of my book in any capacity, and certainly not kind of American eugenic philosophies or characters or historical agents. I really wanted this to be book to be about Chilean intellectuals and Chilean concerns. But that's maybe enough from me for now.
Thank you for sharing that. Fascinating. I like how you're just conscious of this the way in which you frame your narrative and your historical perspective. But I wanted to ask you more about how you came to write about this topic. What is it that ultimately drew you to study the intersections of Catholicism eugenics and Chile, and perhaps why Chile in particular?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this book, probably like many first books, is based on my dissertation that I did, which was also about eugenics and Catholicism in Chile. And the way kind of intellectually I came to this was first through the kind of more thematic interest in the interactions between Catholicism and eugenics in Latin America. I had already decided prior to coming to graduate school that I wanted to pursue Latin American history, which I already had specialized in undergraduate school, or in undergraduate actually. And the reason why I chose that particular interaction was because I began being interested in the history of science. And what I discovered quite quickly when you read anything about the history of science at that time, which I'm sorry to age myself, was kind of the mid-2000s, Latin America was a region that was portrayed as at best a place where scientific ideas from elsewhere, the kind of argument was we can discuss how well or not well they've been adapted or implemented. And it wasn't really about Latin American people themselves having scientific ideas, generating scientific ideas. And so that really was striking to me. And in particular, a lot of the arguments were very much tied up with the idea that Latin America as a region is predominantly Catholic and correspond, and then a kind of corollary assumption that Catholicism as a religious belief is antithetical to scientific development because it hinders kind of originality and innovation that is required of science. There's a lot of reasons this belief in both of these things persists beyond the early 2000s. But that was really striking to me quite immediately. And so I wanted to investigate if that were really true. And in particular, I had already done some reading about eugenics in Latin America in a number of different locations. And it was clear to me that eugenics was really, really popular, much as it was all over the world in any number of different types of communities, religious or otherwise. And so, from the history of science and history of eugenics side, most of the literature coming out of that at the time was saying that Catholicism in particular was especially hostile to eugenics. And so to me, that seemed to be incongruous with what I had already been kind of figuring out. So the first thing that I wanted to better understand was the relationship between eugenics and Catholicism as a way to kind of have a more targeted vision of this interaction between Catholicism and science, broadly speaking. So that was the first kind of set of questions that I wanted to ask. In terms of deciding where I wanted to place that in the Latin American context, I had my first advisor, I had two advisors over my graduate school days, Barbara Weinstein and Karen Rosenblatt. And Barbara was my first advisor. And she and I spoke about where I might place this research. And, you know, I think one of the things that maybe doesn't get discussed as much in the context of intellectual pursuits, but is really valuable, is practical advice. And Barbara was eminently practical. And she said, in addition to thinking about what countries make sense, because in terms of there are major pockets within Latin American studies that relate to Mexico, Cuba, Brazil, Argentina. These are kind of the big ticket places that a lot of people spend their time doing research. And so Chile has become more part of that over the recent years. And so she mentioned some places and said, you know, that's one thing to consider, is you want to make sure that your book actually has impact to a broad spectrum of people. And if you choose a relatively small place, it's just not going to have that same impact. And then as well, and this is where the real kind of practicality comes in, she was like, and you should also think very strongly about a place that you would like to live for 6 months, because that's the minimum amount of time you will spend doing archival research in these places. So between those two things, I kind of pondered it for a bit, and I was fortunate enough to have some preliminary research money that the University of Maryland provided. So I used that to go to Chile to do preliminary research, because I had the feeling that it would be a good fit, but I wasn't entirely sure. So I wanted, and part of the reason I thought that is because it had some of the older and most prestigious universities in Latin America, broadly speaking. And I felt like that would provide information as well as a kind of more robust scientific community than some other places. And so I did this preliminary research, and it turned out to be, I found material, and that seemed like a good enough reason to continue forward. What I would say now, after having, because that was so many years ago, I actually don't even fully remember when it was. When I think about Chile now in the context of this book, I think it could be written perhaps in almost any place, but I think Chile offers some unique opportunities to think about certain kind of issues to do with race and white supremacy that are not unique to Chile, but get manifested in particular ways in Chile that I think are kind of really illustrative. And so as time has gone on, I've felt even more kind of committed to the idea of this book placing itself in the Chilean context, which again, I can talk a bit more about if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. That's a fascinating story. Thank you for sharing that. And I would like to ask you about more specifically about one of the main themes that you discuss in your book, which is just how eugenic science and Catholicism kind of, you say, reckoned with one another. And you mentioned that you, in order to examine this, you treat them both as kind of ideologies and intellectual frameworks that were interacting. But I would like to ask you to talk a little more about how you see them intersecting more strongly in terms of the threats that they identified to this concept that you bring up, which is the raza chilena. And I'd like to ask you to talk a little more about that.
Sure. So yes, in terms of kind of concrete threats to La Raza Chilena. And these are, I mean, they kind of build up over time, but we really start to see an accumulation of debates and discussions about this, starting more or less at the turn of the 20th century, and then carrying kind of till just before 1950. And the threats, again, this is why, you know, we choose places that are on the one hand unique, but also kind of illuminating for more places than, you know. So this book isn't, this book is bound by Chilean realities, but I think is also useful to anyone who wants to understand this moment in time in terms of eugenic thought in particular in Latin America. But in terms of concrete threats that were identified as problems, both by Catholics and by secular reformers in this period, were often gender defined and bifurcated by gender, which is, you know, the other component of the book. So if we were talking about the threats that Chilean men present to La Raza Chilena, the primary concern amongst most people who identified themselves as eugenicists was alcoholism, without a doubt. There is a strong belief that men simply cannot control the amount of alcohol that they consume. And this is a problem, eugenically speaking, not only because it damages the physical body of the man who is drinking too much, which of course has any number of potentially eugenic related problems, but perhaps the most concerning is that perhaps he is damaging his actual ability to reproduce by too much drinking. So that's a major concern. Another concern related to that is that a man will privilege the amount of money he saves or dedicates to drinking, and does not use that money to do the things that should be done to have a eugenic household. Perhaps there is no home that is bought. Perhaps the home is not adequate to the amount of people that are living in it. Perhaps this is the other presumption, he's the sole breadwinner for the family. So perhaps there is no bread at the house because he's spent most of his money on drink rather than providing for his family. These are some of the main concrete concerns. And again, this speaks to kind of the ideological correlation and correspondence between Catholicism and eugenic thought, because of course Catholicism, similarly Catholic priests for quite a long time, in fact, long before eugenics came along, were trying to encourage men to drink less and to participate in family life more. So that's kind of, for men, the main concern is of that persuasion for the most part. For women, the most pressing threat to La Raza Chilena is all bound up in reproduction. So how many children are women having and what quality of children are they having? And this second thing is actually off, I would say, maybe even more important than the first. The quality is how we measure that varies quite a lot across the eugenic community in Chile. But the overall belief is that we want to be producing children who are physically fit, who are a certain amount of mentally capable, and who effectively, in kind of any way you might measure this, could be read as white. And we can talk more about what I mean by that. But the kind of onus on women to do the vast majority of work related to the integrity and maintenance of the physical health of La Raza Chilena is profoundly based on reproductive issues. So whereas men are being encouraged to use their time wisely and use their money effectively, women are being encouraged to pick men who are better and or demand better behavior from men. So we see again, and this is again where Catholic and secular reformers can find agreement. We see a lot of discussion across this period of time about trying to address the sexual double standard, which is to say that men seemingly are allowed to have sex with whoever they want, but women need to maintain, premarital sexual purity. And after that, they need to maintain marital sexual fidelity. There's a lot of effort to try and encourage men to do the same. And now it isn't simply kind of a moral good to do that. It actually gives a physical benefit in the improvement and continued health of La Raza Chilena. So they're extremely gendered kind of threats. But the overall concern is, to me, a much less obvious and clear kind of fear about degeneration of La Raza Chilena. And it's not always entirely clear what that means, but it manifests in these much more clear directives about men controlling their alcohol consumption and women creating kind of the perfect conditions in which to have as many children as they possibly can.
Wow, that's fantastic. And you mentioned the intersection of those kind of ideas with a concept of whiteness. So if you could expand on that as you were making a connection there, I would love to hear more about that.
Sure. So this is an aspect of the book that wasn't in my dissertation because it actually took me kind of a long time to think this through and to also have kind of the proper language to really discuss it. And part of the difficulty in arriving at the kind of realization that what was happening here had to do with the construction of a white identity in Chile was because, and this is, I think, one of my larger contributions to the field, I hope, because white identity in Latin America is something that a lot of people don't really want to see in quite the same way that it exists in places like the United States or Australia or the United Kingdom. Even though anyone who is from Latin America could tell you that they know white people who are from there, there's so much emphasis on the idea that the region is racially and ethnically diverse, and on top of that, is not racist. It makes it really quite difficult to talk about racial identity in those spaces, especially when that identity is white. Because this is kind of the nature of white racial identity in most places. It has been treated as basically invisible. So while there's been kind of a renaissance, or there started to be a renaissance talking about kind of Afro-Latino communities and Afro-Latin Americans, that started really seeing a lot of interest, at least amongst historians, kind of at the turn of the 21st century. There was always, of course, an awareness and interest in indigenous cultures and societies in Latin America. But the idea that white people were there and were correspondingly kind of constructing narratives about themselves has taken kind of a while to gel, I would say. So to me, I think it's really important to tell those stories because, one, it does another thing that I think is really important, which is break down the supposed kind of massive barrier between Latin America and the rest of the Americas, which is to say, particularly the United States, but also other nations that we might characterize as white majority. These nations, like anywhere in the Americas, shares a lot more in common than what distinguishes them. And white supremacy exists in all spaces because that is how these nations were originally originally organized around that as a foundational principle. And that's true anywhere that you choose, right? So what I started to notice when I looked at my materials and what people were really, what Chileans were saying about what they thought they were doing, it was very much about creating a racially homogenous population. That was essential. You see that over and over again in across the board. And when I'm like, okay, so what did racially homogenous mean to these individuals? And what they were talking about was, you know, a homogenous form of mestizaje, a homogenous group of mestizos, and that homogeneity created a racial superiority over other countries that were their neighbors or were of similar kind of to their mind level. So often you see this notion of racial homogeneity functioning as racial superiority used against particularly Peru and Bolivia, which are often described as indigenous countries, whereas Chile is not. In the context of a comparison with Brazil, the issue there is that that is primarily an Afro-descended population. And so Chile is different and better than both. And so, you know, one might say, well, racial homogeneity isn't necessarily whiteness, Sarah. And to that, I would say, well, they sure are talking about people who aren't white and how they're better than them. So that to me suggests that this is about being white. And I'll also say quite often Latin Americanists say, well, don't you mean whitened or whitening? Because especially like in the Brazilian case, you have the program of embrancamento. And that is not what I'm saying. I'm very pointedly not saying that, because the literature, like, so by the time we get to the turn of the 20th century, what people in Chile are arguing is that they have been whitened. They are not in a process of doing that. Effectively, the mestizaje time has finished. And in fact, it finished about 100 years before the 20th century began, because most every, like when you look at these books, the one, La Raza Chilena is one of the most emblematic by Nicolás Palacios, but there are others that are of similar kind of time period and gravitas, I guess you could say, where they all place the racially mixed period of Chilean history to actually predate Chile entirely, to have it be in the colonial era. And then as soon as we hit the early 1800s and the independence national period, effectively mestizaje is already over. So in that sense, I feel very strongly that this isn't about a project of whitening. This is about firming up and establishing as kind of like strongly as possible, a version of whiteness that also allows for a history of mestizaje to exist alongside it. And just as a final wrap up, part of what made me start thinking about this is that there was a survey done in 2007, I want to say, by some sociologists, some Chilean sociologists that asked people to identify themselves racially. And most Chileans, the vast majority, chose a box that in English translated to predominantly white mestizo. And that phrase like really stuck with me for a long time. I was like, what does a predominantly white mestizo mean? And so basically, that was kind of probably the starting point for me to really dig into, these kind of issues of racial identity and naming, in a way that I hadn't really thought about before. And so I should have probably started with that and then gone back to what I started this answer with.
Well, no, fascinating. Thank you, for speaking of that. And you were kind of talking
signaling to this idea of the process of mestizaje being over, and the debates about eugenics and how to apply eugenic science were mostly about kind of uplifting the raza chilena, right? But you also, in chapter two, especially the first part of the book, you talk about how secular eugenicists, as you call them, saw just the church or Catholicism as kind of a separate almost category here, but in contrast, Catholic intellectuals or Catholics who had an affinity for eugenic science tried to craft an intellectual space for them in these debates because they saw it as crucial. Their participation is crucial in the construction or uplifting of the raza chilena. So I wonder if you could tell us a little more about that.
Sure. So they not only thought that their involvement in the uplifting of la raza chilena was crucial, it was also a much broader feeling that eugenics without Catholic intervention would go horribly wrong. That Catholicism would provide the moral compass that was so obviously necessary to something like eugenics. And in that sense, I think it's kind of surprising that that line of reasoning wasn't more common in other places, because we certainly know that eugenics did very much need quite a lot of ethical intervention. Now, I'm not sure that the Catholic Church was really the right institution to offer that, but I think it's an interesting kind of place to start, that they felt very strongly that eugenics offered a lot of good benefits. Particularly, it kind of mirrored what they were trying to do, which was to tell people how to live a good life, right? In very concrete terms. But there was a concern that eugenics without any sort of moral or ethical code would be kind of leading people down a dangerous path. And there were lots, and Catholics disagreed about what the dangers were, but they still agreed that Catholicism should be there to prevent that. But in terms of how they kind of spoke to this, a lot of the arguments that I started to see coming out of Catholic writing of this period was about building on older traditions of scientific development and discovery, in which Catholic typically, like kind of clerical figures, people who were monks, right, and in different orders, how they had played a fundamental role in the foundation of a variety of different sciences in the early modern period, particularly things like astronomy and botany. And so the idea was here that what Catholics in Chile were trying to argue, and I don't think this was unique to Chile, was that the effort of some members of the eugenic community to try and purposefully keep them out of the discussion and out of the debate was actually a perversion of a much longer standing reality about how science and religion always tend to function together. And in fact, when they function together, they both function better, because ultimately what both are about is the revelation of truth and the revelation of how the world works, and offering you guides to then how to navigate that, right? So that was really, I think, kind of the fundamental purpose of a lot of this Catholic writing, was to show that there was a much longer tradition of science and religion functioning together, and that this kind of more recent, and to their mind, starting at the beginning of the 20th century, this more recent kind of appeal to science as the only thing a person needed was an aberration, and would result in poor outcomes, because it wouldn't be as fully realized as what had preceded it, and that to keep Catholics out was an arbitrary decision that they resented. I mean, they resented it. And so the effort was to try and convince people that, or convince secularists, I guess, that they deserved as much kind of space at the table as anyone else. And that, and most importantly, that they were not wanting to be there to be obstructionist, that in fact, and this is quite often also language in these articles, especially about eugenics, is that they repeatedly say how much they are eager for these improvements and how they want to help, but that they're not being permitted entry into these various kind of debates or public spaces, and that they want to be included. So that's really, to me, kind of the issue here, is that it's they're trying to maintain or really create a new space for themselves in these more public debates about ultimately, I guess, public health in a sense, even though it's misplaced.
Yeah. Well, and kind of building off that, a point that you made about just them trying to participate in these public debates, there are also two other themes that I kind of see as interconnected here. You speak of how the Chilean example kind of speaks to how Latin American forms of racialized or racial thought were distinct, right? However, you also discuss this idea of Catholic eugenicists intervening in these debates through an identified imprecision in the relationship between heredity and the environment. So it's sort of through this lack of consensus, which also connects to how eugenics at a transnational, international level function, right? That's where they saw a space where they entered in. Could you please tell us a little more about this? I find this fascinating, just the many facets of this process and how it manifested within the Chilean case specifically.
Sure. Yeah, so I think that's one of the other things that to me was really important to capture. I imply it in a sense, and I do talk about kind of the transnational connections in varying parts of the book. But it's really important to remember in any study of eugenics that up until the 1930s, it's really unclear to pretty much anyone involved how heredity actually works. And even now, we still don't really understand many of the aspects of how different traits are inherited. In fact, the more we learn, the less clear most of these traits and how they pass from parent to child become. So that's, I think, it's a reminder to those of us in the present, because even historians sometimes suffer from a bit of presentism or kind of an imprecision about understanding what did people know at what time and what kind of constitutes a good faith effort at that time of really trying to understand what was available as information at any given moment in time. And it's certainly true that I think, broadly speaking, eugenics benefited from the fact that people didn't really understand how heredity worked. They just simply couldn't understand it because there wasn't any meaningful information for quite a while. And even when we get to the modern synthesis in the 1930s, which combines kind of ideas about genetics with Darwinian theory, that's not as though all of a sudden now we understand everything. It's just that the science can now begin, the kind of much more what we might call legitimate science can meaningfully begin. So for the period that I'm talking about, which is more or less the first half of the 20th century, we're dealing with a very malleable set of ideas, which, as you point out, and as I say in the book, allows for a really broad spectrum of people to engage with eugenics and eugenic theory, and feel like they are doing right by it. You know, they feel like they understand it just as much as anyone else. And I mean, that's arguably true in a lot of cases. So that's, I think that's irrespective of where you are. That's true in Chile. That's true in England. That's true in the United States. People at this period of time think they know quite a bit, when in reality, they are working off very partial information, and making kinds of an incredible amount of theoretical presumptions that, of course, we come to see don't really work, but at the time are no kind of less, how would I put it, no less reasonable than anything else in many ways. So that, I think, is just kind of the landscape in which then you can place developments in Chile into, because that remains true in Chile as well. And then kind of it also, and again, this is part of, you know, why you can write a book about one place and it can be useful for somebody studying a different place. Eugenics too is not only a transnational kind of movement, it is also uniquely localized. And in particularly in the Latin American case, eugenics is very much bound by the borders of each nation and what they aim to do. Like I said, in the Chilean case, the purpose of eugenics that most people are talking about is further refining the racial homogeneity that characterized that place, or at least they believed it characterized the place. If you look at what eugenicists in Brazil or Peru or Argentina are discussing, they are uniquely different strands of kind of a similar stream of thought based on what people presume to be true about the populations of those nations. And so, you know, I think that to me is what is so fascinating about this and why it merits study is, you know, the actual very real intellectual fluidity of these ideas. Meanwhile, the way people are using them is extremely kind of circumscribed and concrete. They think they know precisely what they're doing. But all it takes is just kind of to take one step back and see, well, they're really sure of these kind of claims they're making, but I don't know how anyone could be. And so that's, I think, what I wanted to try and uncover here. And in particular, to, I guess, move away from the idea that, well, one, that Latin Americans simply just don't science good. and two, that, like, how would I put it? That eugenics is a pseudoscience, and therefore no wonder, like, anybody kind of thought they could do it. It was truly something that appealed to people at a fundamental level and was treated as very serious business. And so, despite that seriousness, there was a really fundamental lack of clarity because there was just not enough information that, I mean, that time, it was only going to, time was the only thing that was going to fix that. So again, I guess it's just about trying to be respectful of the people and the intellectuals and the ideas of that particular moment. I guess you could kind of think of it as trying to capture this snapshot of a moment and really take it as seriously as possible, without just being like, well, everyone kind of ruined this and no one understood anything.
Yeah, that you were speaking a moment ago about just how important the national or local context is. And in your book, you sort of get at how important nationalism or this kind of blend of Catholic and eugenic ideas were in shaping the raza chilena, which was clearly framed in terms of national identity in relation to Chile, right? Especially you mentioned the work of Nicolás Palacios, who wrote La Raza Chilena. But something that I wanted to bring up, I remember being and surprised how in the final parts of your book you talk about Allende and Pinochet. But I bring that up to kind of speak a little more to what you were mentioning, that this idea that racial thought is not as prominent in Latin America as in other places, this is not the case, right? And that's sort of what you talk about. And I wonder if you could tell us a little more about how you see that happening here, and even in some instances you connect it to more contemporary historical development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that you start to see when you do read into kind of history of race and ethnicity, or not even just history, just race and ethnicity in Latin America, if you want to do any research on that, either in the historical, in any historical period, or in contemporary studies, like if you're doing Latin American cultural studies, a kind of general truism that you'll run across is that the way race is conceptualized at its fundamental level is different in Latin America. And whether this is said explicitly or not, quite often the implication is that the contrast is with the United States in particular. In other words, that race it's essential in both regions, but the line in the sand around whiteness in North America is incredibly clear and defined. And then all kind of subsequent ideas about race come from that initial distinction. In the Latin American case, the idea of race, and by that I mean like just like what is it and who has it and who cares, the idea of race is very much bound up in the notion of blending, right? Mestizaje, mestizagen, metisage. Like all throughout Latin America, there are all these words to capture that. And so there, in a sense, there is no line between white and everybody else. And from that grows all other kinds of sets of ideas about identity or nationalism or whatever. But, you know, I think that distinction between North America and the rest of the Americas is more kind of, it's true and it's not true, I suppose. Because it, like, the fact remains that being white throughout the Americas gives you privilege that other people simply do not have. You can't deny that being true. So clearly, whiteness absolutely matters in all of these contexts, even if there is a certain kind of acceptance or pragmatism around racial mixing. So that, to me, is actually kind of the more meaningful discussion to have. And that's what I talk about in this book, which is if then in the Latin American context, the issues surrounding racial identity emerge from racial mixing, that helps us to understand in turn how nationalism functions in these places. Because, or at least in the 20th century, it's different in the 19th century. But in the 20th century, the nationalism that starts to emerge within different Latin American nations is very much bound up in racial and ethnic identity, much as nationalism is everywhere in the world at the same time. And I would say that's because of the rise of the importance of eugenics, broadly speaking, all over the Americas, but all over the world. When we hit the 20th century, we start to see a lot of narratives about these are our people. This is how we know they are ours, because they have this heritage, because they have this physical appearance, because if you cross the border, people will have a different physical appearance. People will have a different heritage. People will have a different language, perhaps. And so that is what you start to see coming to fruition in the first half of the 20th century throughout Latin America, that you should really be able to, and it does start happening before that, but I think it kind of comes to its full maturation across this period, where again, there's this presumption that, like, if I'm a Chilean, I should absolutely know the difference between myself and a Bolivian. That should be easy. Between myself and an Argentinian, obviously. Between myself and a Brazilian. Between myself and a Colombian. Between myself and a Mexican. And not only should I know that difference, but I also recognize that all of those other countries I just mentioned are also different from each other. And the reason that they're different is because their history and legacy of racial mixture is different and unique to themselves, right? Each one has their own history of interaction with European colonization and kind of various economic extraction models that facilitated different kinds of contact between different groups of people. And so that is why now, as we get into the 20th century, we have these distinctions, and why it's so important for us to kind of be proud of our heritage and our thing. I mean, in the Chilean case, not only are most of the eugenicists arguing that, you know, La raza chilena is a unique homogenous race, and in and of itself, that's cool. They're also saying in the world, we are a unique version of humanity that other groups and other people should want to study and should take seriously, because where else in the world do you have this predominantly white mestizo thing, you know? And in fact, by the time we get to the 1930s and beyond, we start to see many Latin American like academics and intellectuals and political leaders start to take this message of how they are good at race mixing out into the world at large. Like, for example, a really obvious but always useful example is when you think about racial democracy in Brazil, right? Gilberto Freire is the person who coins the term and kind of comes up with a general idea. But in fact, that idea predated him as well. But the idea that there is something unique to Latin Americans that facilitates a really good racial mixture process. Chileans say this too, because they say, look at how thorough our racial mixture was. We really kind of bled out all of the bad indigenous qualities that we don't want here. We got rid of those. And so shouldn't we be like sending out that message to the world? Don't other countries want to know how to do this? And so that to me, I think, is really an intriguing kind of way to think about if there is a difference, which again, the difference is minimal at best, between Latin America and North America, it lies in this kind of belief that Latin Americans have kind of a special talent at racial mixing, which in turn, the argument often goes, means that they are not racist, and it has somehow done away with any possibility of racial conflict. The argument there being that if you cannot claim pure whiteness, then you cannot claim any of the corresponding privileges or supremacy that goes with pure whiteness. And I guess what one of the things I wanted to show in this book is that it doesn't matter about the purity of the whiteness. What matters is the concept and the existence of people who feel they can access that identity. And so that's, you know, really how this all functions, and certainly absolutely contributes to kind of nationalist ideas about who is the better nation, who is the stronger nation, you know. And it has a real meaningful impact in how Latin American nations interact with each other, for sure.
Yeah, I find it absolutely interesting and intriguing, especially the way you put it in your book, that even this sort of embrace of mestizaje and racial mixing at the same time is not necessarily inclusive, but also has just kind of racist undertones in it. You call it an invisibilization of other racial categories by just trying to homogenize it, right? So I find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, because I mean, and again, this is a story that is told in most Latin American countries. I'm just talking about the Chilean one. But typically, if you look at these stories of like, what are our founding peoples? Who are the contributors to the mixed race legacy that we are all inheritors of now? Typically, it's only one indigenous group that is identified as the kind of parent indigenous group for the entire nation. And then, of course, there's some category of Europeans who is the other parent of the nation. Typically, anybody of African descent is not characterized as a parent of the nation. And that's even kind of true in Brazil, which is intriguing. And so there's like kind of this look back to the colonial past as a starting point, and then a selection process about precisely who you're going to say were the important kind of progenitors and contributors to your now present contemporary national identity. And so, yes, well, on the one hand, you would think, well, they're celebrating this indigenous heritage. I guess that seems good. Or it certainly looks progressive, you know, when somebody's celebrating Lautaro in 1917. I mean, that seems certainly very progressive from the vantage point of 2022, maybe. But then you have to think about like, well, what precisely, what is being celebrated? Who does this represent? Who's telling these stories? And, you know, in the case of Chile, the group that's identified is the, well, and that's the other thing. They certainly never say Mapuche. That's not the word that's ever used. They've even come up with a whole other term, which is Araucanians. And so, I mean, to me, that seems quite obvious then that we are not celebrating indigeneity in its kind of richest sense. We're talking about a very specific and select kind of version of the past. And what really drives it home in the case of the Chilean story about this, and this is another Palacios claim, he doesn't even say broadly that these are Europeans who came to Chile. He doesn't even say that they're Spanish, because he actually thinks the Spanish are terrible. He's gone through a whole thing where, in fact, there's this kind of subset of people of Germanic heritage who ended up in the Iberian Peninsula, who then in turn came to Chile, you know, which is an incredible amount of, I don't even know how to describe it, kind of selective reading of the past to come up with a story that you feel comfortable with. But even that, I mean, so that's the thing is like, at first when I read that, I was like, this guy is clearly nuts. I don't know what he's thinking. But then I started looking around, and in fact, there was so much kind of anti-Latin feeling in the early 20th century, that there was quite a lot of writing in, and I know the term Latin is problematic in its own ways, but in Latin cultures or in countries identified as such, all throughout the Iberian Peninsula, Italy, throughout Central and South America and the Caribbean as well, there's all this writing about how, in fact, there was a strange Germanic strand in Latin culture that, how do I want to say this? Like, this all truly to figure this out is quite something. But basically, the argument was that when Rome was sacked by the various Germanic tribes, that then this kind of synergy between Germanic and Latin culture, it came to exist, and that saved Latin peoples from some of the worst aspects of their own kind of racial heritage. You can believe that or not, but that, I mean, this, at, you know, I'll just say that was a surprisingly widespread belief. Which then, you know, then we come to Chile, and there's this also kind of additional stuff that I think is really interesting, because even now you can go, I think it's Puerto Montt, but there are whole like German looking towns in southern Chile. And the reason that those are there is because people really believed this kind of supposed Germanic connection between Chileans and Austrians and Germans. And they then created a special kind of immigration program that facilitated the arrival of German and Austrian migrants to southern Chile, which had even another level of weird kind of racial improvement built upon it, because southern Chile is where the vast majority of Mapuche people were. And so there was a feeling like, on the one hand, we can get this kind of connection to our ancestry by getting Germanic peoples to come to Chile. On top of it, they can do the work of what the term that often gets used as pacifying the Mapuche. And then on top of that, it's like, oh, and also Germanic people like the cold weather. And that's what southern Chile is. It's cold, cold, cold. So we can do all of this at once.
So many different intersections that they find.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, stuff like that is just, I mean, it's the reason why you do books like this, because you run across this strange thing. And at first you think it's just this one person who's kind of eclectic or is eccentric or something. And then you start looking around and then you're like, oh no, this was not some strange idea this person came up with on their own. There was actually a tradition of this, and then it becomes kind of, yeah, like these truisms, or kind of like, oh, it's always been this way and this is how we do things. And so, yeah, I mean, all of that, to me is, I guess, the point of doing this stuff is so you can better understand how people actually think that this works. And I guess as well, kind of to get back to the original point, how inclusivity and exclusivity exist like in tandem, right? Like we can celebrate diversity while still simultaneously kind of systematically and systemically not supporting that in reality.
Yeah, this is an absolutely fascinating history, and just the intersections between these two seemingly just discrete intellectual frameworks, to use your phrase, it's just fascinating. So thank you so much for talking about that. And as sort of a final question, we've taken a lot of your time so far. So if you wouldn't mind talking about any projects that you may be working on or are planning to work on in the future, whether related to these topics, we would love to hear about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good question. The pandemic kind of put a cramp in anything I was hoping to do for a while. So I'm doing a couple articles that are still connected to this research in some ways. I'm in the process of finishing up and preparing to submit an article about Chilean martial strength, which is to say military strength, at the turn of the, or really end of the 19th century, as an opportunity to reflect on Chile's racial superiority and white identity relative to Peru and Bolivia. So that article is specifically about this war memorial in downtown Santiago to the Roto Chileno is what it's called. And so that's a bit of a departure for me because it has a bit more to do with like visual culture and art history. So that's one of the things I'm looking, and it's an earlier time period than I'm normally accustomed to. So that's one thing I'm doing. And then I'm trying to think, put together an article about, broadly speaking, Chilean healthcare in the first half of the 20th century that I'm only just starting to think about because I was asked to contribute an article to a special issue about Latin American healthcare in the modern era. So I need to think a bit about what I want to say about that. Though I have a feeling it will be, again, kind of about the interconnections between race and gender in the context of healthcare. And then more kind of like longer term projects. I've really been wanting for a while, like because the pandemic sort of changed my plans for what I hoped to do, I started thinking about doing a project based on published materials or like media that I could access digitally. And so I have the hope that I might start doing a longer term project. And I'm not sure if it would be like a few different articles or build into an entire book, but about science fiction in Latin America and its connections. Yeah, its connections, again, like everything I do, I kind of circle back to race and ethnicity because I really do think there needs to be more work, not only on white identity kind of making and what it is in Latin America, but also how white supremacy functions in Latin America. So I have a vision of what I would like to see out of this Latin American science fiction thing, but I haven't yet actually gotten any, like I've done some secondary reading, but I need to find some primary sources. But that would be a more comparative project where I'd be looking at a few different countries precisely to get at what I mentioned in this interview, which is that because racial mixing informs national identity so much, I would expect to see kind of different visions of the future in different countries. Like, what do we expect the future of Brazil is going to be, or the future of Chile, or the future of Argentina or Mexico? So we'll see about that. I really hope I can find the time to do it because it feels like it might be just a little bit a more fun way to deal with a serious topic that I, like I've done the serious way of doing a serious topic. And I would like to maybe just watch some old movies or read some old books.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds fascinating. Sounds like a great project. So I would like to thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed both reading your book and talking to you about it. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Claudia, and thank you for inviting me.